from the Bonnet College. The Hand and Eye of Vecna first appeared in the Eldritch Wizardry supplement in 1976. Back then, all we knew about Vecna was that he was a lich that left some body parts behind. Vecna's name is an anagram of Vance in honor of author Jack Vance. The idea of a matched hand and eye set of artifacts comes from Michael Moorcock, where the Corum stories introduce the Hand of Quill and the Eye of Rin. Vecna has had a resurgence in modern times, at least in part due to Stranger Things using Vecna for the name of its most recent season's villain. If you still can't get enough Vecna, you can put your life in Vecna's hands by using Vecna Healthcare's online health portals. No, that's totally a thing, but I wouldn't use my hand or my eye with either of those.
And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, the multiverse may come unraveled if we don't play D&D.
I'm Chris. I am the Morden Kanan of the Misdirected Mark podcast, as that is a bit of a hint of what we're talking about today. I also am a game designer over at Encoded Designs. I do a bunch of that. And you can hear all the stuff that I make over on polygamero.us.
Hey, I know that place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew. You know, Ange and I were talking about changing this from years to like the actual number of years. And I looked at this and it's like, I've been gaming for almost 40 years. That doesn't sound any better than saying 1985.
That's true.
However, in addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
It's such a weird intro, right? Like, I'm totally going to derail us right at the beginning because I'm the editor. Yeah. I can do that. I feel that the number of years that you've been gaming matters less than the level of knowledge that you can bring to the table to assist people in gaming. That's just me.
Yeah, this is generally true. I broadly agree with that statement.
Yeah, I will cite Ginny D as being, she's only been doing this for about like 6 or 7 years, and she is quite knowledgeable about all stuff gaming. So, you know, just throwing that out there.
Definitely.
Anyways, after we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about modifying the adventure Vecna, Eve of Ruin. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment. For me, it might be about things that are blowing up over on Dimension 20.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, Jared, we've been playing some games lately, huh?
Uh-huh.
Looks like you actually got to play some games. I'll talk about mine first.
That sounds good.
But sometimes I listen to this segment when you and Andrew are talking about it, and it's like, we didn't do anything. And I'm like, oh, it's sad. And I'm like, I know that you didn't do nothing. I think that's proper English. It could be wrong. But I'm always like, they played other games. They just didn't play D&D. And I understand that.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about my Coriolis game quite as often here.
Yeah. I won't talk about my Master Nalathotep Call of Cthulhu game, but I will talk about my very long ongoing D&D game, which people are going to jump into this in the middle. So I'll try to keep it brief. They are all like 11th level at this point in time. They're in this giant mountain called the Barren Tor. It is the domain of the Avatar of Earth, which they're like my gods in that world, except you can kill them and it makes more sense because they're not gods. Not that they're going to kill the Avatar of Earth. Anyways, they're rolling around in here because they're trying to get this sword before this Dark Knight gets the sword so that the Dark Knight can't use the sword to destroy the Avatar of Hope, which is wielded by one of the characters. And the Avatar of Hope is a sword because I like swords. So they're trying to get the key to get into the vault. It's called the Cambrian Vaults. This person called Vogel Meyer has it. He's an archmage that helped build these vaults. He's still living here. He's a time mage. Time mages have a problem where if they use too much time magic, these time wraiths come and try to touch them. If they touch them, they just get disintegrated. So they have to like take exceptional precautions to not get disintegrated. So Vogel Meyer has this place called Vogel Meyer's Rest inside of the mountain. They go to Vogel Meyer's Rest. They find out that Vogelmeyer has made 50 different time duplicates of himself. So there's like 50 archmages running around here. But they're really nice for the most part. They're actually pretty happy to see somebody that's not a Vogelmeyer. Unfortunately, one of the Vogelmeyers, Vogelmeyer number 4, also known as the Plant God, he has the key that they need. And they have shunted him off into a little pocket dimension inside of this place. So yes, it's a dungeon inside of a dungeon inside of a dungeon. Just for the Inception dungeon that's going on there. And they've been making their way through this little plant god dungeon because he is basically poison ivy. They have not been having a good time of it. They're all beat to ever live in love when they run into the plant god. And instead of fighting him, they talk to him because what he wants to do is leave. And he has convinced them all in a way to go through the puzzle of his dungeon to create the thing that will allow him to escape this pocket dimension. Now, he's not evil per se, but he's like a lich that needs to feed on souls. So, like, he's basically a serial killer that needs to eat people every now and again to survive.
Yeah.
Right? Not great. Now, not all of them are great people either. Like this party, the half of them are not very nice folks, which is fine. I'm okay with that. One of them also becomes enamored with Plant Guy because Plant Guy could just like produce cucumbers if he wants to and hand them to the water bending monk, which, by the way, I've decided that the water bending monk, like, he's like the only person that can bend water in the world. It is a monk using that monk, the elemental four ways, but we just flavor everything towards water because she wanted to be a waterbender from the swamp. I'm like, that's fine. You could do that. This is my group that is much more casual. We drink a lot and eat food and stuff before we actually play the game. I play a lot of games, folks. It's just a thing. Anyways, they decide to work with Vogelmeier number four, the plant god, which my wife, who also plays in that game, she's like, I'm never calling him that. It's like an ongoing joke now. She said it like 12 times. So his stipulation for being let out is all these other Vogelmeiers are going to try to kill him. So he wants to kill them. But in his plant godness, he's figured out how to get rid of his time dysphoria. So time dysphoria is what causes these wraith things to try to kill you. His methodology has actually made him immune to the time dysphoria. So there is a trap inside of this part of the dungeon in Vogelmeier's Rest that whenever these time wraiths appear, they appear inside of this wall of force style box that can hold them. So there's like 1,000 of them that just kind of pop up and keep getting stuck in this one spot. And it's one of the things that they had to make their way around to get through the opening part of Vogelmeier's Rest. Because what do you do at your opening of your dungeon, especially if it's your home? You put all your traps out there because you don't want people bothering you. Which was fun. They're like, well, this place is weird. I'm like, well, you know. And then they realized that was the front door. Like, you basically lock and put things on your front door so that people can't walk into your house. They walk over there. They walked out of the pocket dimension, and one of the Vogelmeiers, because they made friends with these people, was like, hey, and they all just murdered him. Like, one round. I'm like, well, you have one round before he can alert everybody else. They just killed this poor archmage who had no idea that they was gonna kill him. They're like, oh man, that poor guy. By the way, the name of this campaign is called the Heroes of Pirin. They've been very heroic in the past, but not at this current time. So then they make their way to the containment unit with all these time wraiths. Vogelmeier number four, the plant god, says, give me some time to break this open. So they help him. They do it pretty quickly. They release all the wraiths, which then filter through the entirety of the facility, and they hear screams for a second, and then everything goes quiet. And then they all looked at me, and they were all very sad. Because they're like, oh, we did a bad thing. That was my game. So there you go. Because, you know, no context for anything else there, but there you go.
The time race reminded me of that one Eccleston episode of Doctor Who where Rose was trying to save her dad and the things kept coming around and had them pinned down in the church because she changed time and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I think about how long ago that episode was, I feel really old because that seems like new Doctor Who.
Technically new Doctor Who. It's like middle distance Doctor Who now, right? Strangely enough, the time wraith thing came from The Flash, not the not that Doctor Who episode, but that would have made sense.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. That, like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, too. I bet in the back of my head that also came from there, because I've seen that episode a bunch of times. So tell me about your game, Jared.
All right. Well, I was really happy because my Saturday game that I run every month for my daughter and my daughter-in-law and their friend, we just started playing Curse of Strahd. And they all made like fey-related creatures. So we have a bugbear monk and an astral elf and a changeling who is a blood hunter. We'll see how well I actually like that class once I see it in play. However, because they all had this fey theme, we came up with having them start at the Witchlight Carnival instead of on, you know, like a regular campaign setting. And after we had an establishing scene showing what each of them do at the carnival on a day-to-day basis, there was this gigantic storm that was rolling in towards the carnival. Mr. Witch gets his pocket watch out and has them roll up the carnival, and they start to disappear. And they get left behind as the carnival is going away, and the Mists of Ravenloft come around. And they show up on this path at night that leads to a multi-story decrepit house that looks like it's been burned down multiple times. So I am running them through the Death House adventure because they're all first level. I want to give them the whole full on Ravenloft experience here for Curse of Strahd. So
I love me some Curse of Strahd.
Oh yeah. Of all of the things that they have done in 5th edition, it is definitely a classic. Even though Ravenloft has been done before, there is something different about the way they did Curse of Strahd that is really, really pretty neat. They all ended up starting to go through the Death House, and I don't want to spoil anything because I think there are still people that want to play Curse of Strahd that will end up doing this, but one of the last things they saw before they went into the actual house was a man that is very tall and pale with long hair that stepped backwards into the mist after the mist closed in around the house so that they can't leave it. So I wanted to make sure they have a look at Strahd already. They already know who Strahd is. Like, that was part of what sold them on the campaign, is they wanted to interact with Strahd. So I wanted to give them Strahd early. One of the things that I've been doing, which is interesting, I haven't tried this before, but it seemed to work pretty well, is I had Roll 20 up, and I was actually keeping track of where they were at in the Death House on the Roll 20 map. Basically, you know, I could just pull up whatever I wanted to look at, and it was right there. They're not necessarily on there, and I'm sort of running at Theater of the Mind, but if there's any discrepancy about, you know, I thought I was here, then I can just show them the thing and say, okay, this is where I have you. Where would you like to be? So it's kind of an interesting in between, you know, between Theater of the Mind and actually having a map out. And it worked pretty well for this first session.
That's really cool. I mean, I want to talk about this for a second when you're done talking about this game.
The other thing, though, that I noticed is I really like Curse of Strahd. And also, man, there are a lot of WotC adventures that like to try and murder first level characters by throwing ridiculous things at them.
There's only so many good first level monsters.
Yes, it's true. I've been using my tried and true trick of I kind of want things to hit them hard to scare them, but then I've been giving them like the minimum number of hit points so that like as long as you hit this thing, you will probably take it out, but it's going to scare you the first time it takes its turn.
Yeah, horror gaming is hard with Dungeons and Dragons, right? Because it's a heroic fantasy game.
Mm-hmm.
And characters have a lot of power. I mean, even at first level, I mean, maybe not first level. First level characters are kind of, they could do like two things for the most part. But yeah, man, horror in D&D is hard, I would say. It's a whole nother topic. I mean, we won't get into it here. I want to talk about this Roll 20 using the maps and whatnot and the benefits of it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I've done some stuff like this before, too, for different games. I think it's really useful because having the map in front of you allows you to have a visual reference, if you're a visual person, to describe things to the players.
Mm-hmm.
And if you decide to throw some tokens on there just for your own edification, you can play it Theater of the Mind or like relative positioning for yourself then, so that if, once again, if anybody has any confusion, you have a better, clearer view of what's going on yourself, so you can describe it more accurately. I think it's a very smart way to run a game where you want to use Theater of the Mind.
It flowed really well. I mean, I didn't stop to get out a map and draw anything out or anything like that. And I think that works really well with them because they're new and they also want to be really into the story. And also, it's a horror story. It needs some atmosphere. And I'm definitely not against using tactical maps because I use them in almost every other thing that I do. But there is something that works really well about just kind of, you know, flowing in and out of combat without pulling out the map and putting all the tokens down and everything in a horror game.
Yeah, man. Then there's that nice, there's just a delineation between what a combat scene looks like and then a every other scene looks like with Roll for Initiative and then action economy. That's really the only difference. No, it's smart. It's clever.
It gives me a little bit of leeway, too, if they are scared of something and want to run away. Nobody has to count anything on the map. I can just say something like, you know, give me an athletics check to see how well you get away from this thing. And then I will put them wherever it seems like they would end up after they ran from the thing.
Man, there's like a whole nother thing to talk about. The intention of design and of the designers and then what the design actually does. Because there are designers for this game that have said, we didn't really intend for it to be played with a gridded map. I mean, we used feet and things like that, but we just figured it was like space because that was what the game was always like. And then I wonder if those were the original designers that decided that, and then the people that came afterwards changed that a little bit to fit it to everything else, or what the deal was with that. I have no idea what the history of that is. I'm supposed I could ask a few of the people that have worked on that game. I do know them. Like, I know how to get a hold of them anyway. Maybe not the ones that are on there right now, but the ones that did the work on it before they all got laid off and moved around.
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting, and I think I went into 5th edition not wanting to use maps very often, and I got back into it a lot more once I started running things online since the pandemic. So
in most groups that I play with, I mean, to prolong this topic for even longer, like they like at least having the minis and stuff on the board so they could see where everything is. It just works better for most of the people that I play D&D with. There's the crowd that I play Dungeon World with and other more story-esque or mapless games, and that's fine for them. Like, I don't need a map on the board or anything like that. I do personally like to sometimes just throw, like, tokens on the table to be like, you're kind of over here, you're kind of over here, so we can, you know, get a relative view of what's happening. But that's me. I also have a giant-ass game table.
And I know, like, when I'm running online, every once in a while I do like to have them on a map where I can throw out a token that is that thing. And they can see the really neat artwork that whatever company commissioned for that thing is. And I can say, this is the thing that's trying to eat your face.
I suppose the moral of the story is there's no right way. There's just a bunch of ways to get that done.
Yeah. And I mean, even like for a person, there's no right way for them to always run too. I mean, this isn't the way I normally run things, but it's working here.
So the moral of the story is you should try a bunch of different things to see what works best for you and your group.
Exactly.
Even in the same campaign.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Now that we've been talking about our campaigns and other ancillary points for a while, let's get into our Dungeon Master's Workshop. Vecna Eve of Ruin is an adventure released to commemorate D&D's 50th anniversary, and it is designed to interact with some famous artifacts and multiple D&D settings that have appeared in the game over the last 50 years. We're going to take a look at what you might want to keep in mind and what you might want to change or add to the adventure to make it work better for you.
I'm so into this. I used to do this all the time on Down with D&D when I used to host that show. We used to take adventures, go through them and be like, we could do it this way. It might work better for you. Just a bunch of thoughts about it. I have not read this as extensively as you, Jared, but I have skimmed all of it. So I can mostly talk about stuff, but we're turning the spoilers on. This is spoilerific. So if you're playing this thing or you want to know other stuff about, don't want to know other stuff about this thing, just, I'm sorry, this is not the episode for you. Just go listen to something else. Go back to the previous episode, skip to the next episode if it's out right now. Whatever you need to do, don't be spoiled by Vecna Eve of Ruin by listening further. Where do you want to start, Jared?
I don't know. Do you want to go like in order or do you want to go by topic?
Let's go by topic. I mean, my primary topic that I studied up on was the big thing, and we talked about this before, is that Cass replaces Mordenkainen in this adventure, and it's stupid. It doesn't feel good, at least to me. That is my opinion.
I do not disagree with you.
If I was running this, I would fix that instantly. I do not like it. I read about how it all plays out. The reveal's even not great. If there's a reveal for Cass being Mordenkainen, there's just a lot of bad pieces as far as bad pieces for me. I mean, I don't look, man, writing this stuff is hard. I'm not here to disparage the designers like this. And there's like editors and people like that. And then they like people above them that have to take care of that. And honestly, the way they have it laid out, it's simple, which is good because sometimes you need things to be simple so that people can run it. And then you have, you know, super nerds like us that show up and be like, well, what if we made it more complicated and did it this way so that it felt like a better story? That's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. And I did a multi-part review on this. And the thing I would like to stress to everyone is while I have some issues with some things in this, one of the things I want to say is, one, nobody is a bad designer that worked on this. And two, even when I didn't like things in this, there are clearly certain focal points and areas and encounters that you can tell they put a lot of work into, and this is what the showcase of this part of the adventure was supposed to be.
Man, the first chapter's really good. Did you like the... I like the first chapter a lot. It's very themey.
Yeah.
It lets you know exactly what's going on. It's got that that part where you get tied to Vecna, also really good for the adventure. I love that a lot. That whole Secrets of Power, that is an expandable idea. Now, all it has right now, I mean, we're going to start there now that we're talking about it. We'll talk about the cast thing in a bit.
Yeah.
The Secrets of Power thing, what you can do is you can spend secrets to get advantage on D20 rolls going for a minute. Everybody in the party. And these are secrets that if you do that, they're gone from your head, which essentially means they probably go to Vecna into his powerful ritual that's going to destroy the multiverse so that he can reform it. That's the plot of the adventure, if you didn't know. you can expand that to do different things. Like you can add on to that you spend a secret, you get something, and you can do some pretty powerful stuff. These are 11th level characters, 10th level characters to begin with. So whatever you want to do that makes sense for the characters, I'm a big proponent of customizing stuff for my characters based on the story that is happening. Context matters a lot to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll get that in this thing that me and Jared and Andrew are playing called, it's called The Heroes of Howl's Way. It'll be out sometime in July. I have a whole bunch of custom stuff for Ange and coming up, and I will have a whole bunch of custom stuff for Jared once I get his Paladin Dreamer wrapped around my head. But the whatever their class is, like, you can just start adding and tacking things on for spending these dreams. They also have some effect at the end when you're actually dealing with Vecna. If you have a bunch of secrets, you can use them to deal with him and his ritual that's going on. So that would be the first place that I would start expanding stuff in this game. But on the base level, it's really good, I think.
Yeah, I like the idea of the secrets. One thing I would say is they let you know to let your players know that these secrets are like things. You know, these are actual concrete philosophical constructs that mean something and that they can spend them. And you are told at a certain point to let them know they can start spending them. The problem I had with that is at the end, if they don't spend them, there is a benefit to it. And I think you really need to let your players know that up front so that they actually can make an informed decision whether or not they're going to burn that for whatever you let them burn it for.
Sure. Let's talk about that for a second. I feel there are probably two ways that I can think of off the top of my head anyway to handle that situation. First is the first time that they spend a secret, you need to narrate how it is going off into the universe and going into the power of the ritual and making it stronger.
Yeah.
So that you are warning them that, yes, you can use these for a temporary power boost, but it is making your life harder later.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you could just tell them what it does. If you have these later, they will help you.
Yeah.
Either one of those works. It just depends on what works best at your table.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with, I mean, you don't need to tell them exactly what it's going to do later on, but I don't think there's anything wrong or it ruins anything to say there may be a benefit later if you don't spend all of these. So you should weigh that, you know, when you're deciding whether or not you're going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go next?
Since you brought up Kaz, I was just going to jump to like our cast in the Wizards 3 and some of the thoughts I had on them, and then we can get into Kaz as part of that.
Sure, let's do it.
So, okay, this adventure uses the Wizards 3, and it is a reference to like old Dragon Magazine articles, which were usually Elminster, Mordenkainen, and someone else. For a while, it was Dalimar from Dragonlance, then it was the symbol for a while. I think Delarzy from Greyhawk was in there for an article or two. So there was kind of this rotating cast of three people talking about things, and the article itself would just give you new spells that one of the wizards had talked about or new magic items. They revisited this concept by coming up with three wizards that are going to be the people that are your patrons guiding you through this task of getting rid of this ritual that Vecna is doing. And they picked Elestriel from Silvery Moon in the Forgotten Realms, Tasha, who has been very heavily featured in a lot of stuff in 5th edition.
She even got a book named after her.
Exactly. And sort of Mordenkainen, but definitely not.
Which also has a book named after him, not him. We're going to fix this, and at least for the people that want to fix it.
And you already heard us talking about this. Kaz, who is the vampire that is the immortal enemy of Vecna, although we should really talk about that one picture too.
They were obviously lovers.
They definitely were. And I think that was awesome, and I wish it would have been more explicit in the text.
You should play them as they were lovers so that when they see each other, if they see each other, it is spiteful.
Oh, yeah.
Like they had a bad breakup.
There is definitely more passion involved there than, you know, if you play that aspect of it up. Anyway, Vecna, this vampire who has been the eternal foe of Vecna ever since the, betrayal, is actually impersonating Mordenkainen. And he is impersonating him with an artifact whose sole purpose is to say your PCs will never figure this out.
Yes. Okay. We're going to have to talk about a few things.
Yeah.
Cass's motivation here. He wants to kill Vecna. His plan is to assemble the Rod of Seven Parts to use it to free Mishka the Wolf Spider in Pandemonium, to then have Mishka and him kill Vecna. Not a bad plan. I actually can see that being pretty usable. The Wizards 3 cast a witch spell to try to disrupt the ritual that Vecna is putting together, because Elestriel figures out that something's going on. She doesn't know exactly what's going on or how Vecna's going to pull it off, but her witch spell doesn't go off because Cass sabotages it, because he's not really a mage. I mean, he's long lived and undead and a vampire, and you can argue that vampires are mages in some way, shape, or form, but not in the wizard way that D&D wizards are wizards.
Yeah.
But in the botched spell, it summons the player characters, which means that the player characters are technically the witch that can disrupt the ritual, which I read that I'm like, oh, well, there you go. I don't know why we're bothering with the disruption of the ritual then. We just have the player characters be the wish spell that gets cast that disrupts the ritual, because you just have to take the longer way because wish spells are stupid that way. I love it. Like, I thought it was cool. Like, why did you bother going the extra step? I know why. So that's what's going on, right? That's what Cass's plan is, to use the player characters to get the Rod of Seven Parts together so that he can go do his thing. Did I cover everything?
Yes, I believe so. The only other thing I would say is that Kaz is the one that suggests using the Rod of Seven Parts, which kind of bugs me because I wish this was something all three of them decided was needed instead of this just being 100% Kaz's side plan that then takes up most of the adventure.
Yeah. So my first question that I wrote to myself was, why would the Wizards 3 want the Rod of Seven Parts? And let me throw this other thing out there before we get to that. I think I want Mordenkainen to be a part of the Wizards 3. I don't think I want Cass to be Mordenkainen in my version. We can talk about your version because I'm curious to hear what you think about this. So it's Mordenkainen's there and he's doing his thing. They try to use the wish spell to disrupt the ritual, but they get the player characters instead. That makes the player characters more important, actually, because they are destined then. They are part of fate at that point in time to be the people that disrupt the ritual. So says the wish spell and whatever fate exists in your D&D multiverse. Now, they do that. And they're like, well, that didn't work. Well, it sort of worked. What's our next plan? And then together, they come up with the idea that we need the Rod of Seven Parts, because what does the Rod of Seven Parts do? It imprisons people. It imprisoned Mishka the Wolf Spider. So they're like, well, we'll use it to imprison Vecna. They don't know exactly where he is, but once they find him, they can then use it to imprison him in some sort of like plane of existence. I'm like, well, that makes sense. I mean, yeah. It's already preset. Like, that already happened once. It could totally happen again. Make sense so far?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right. Cool. So how to insert Cass into the plot? I would say after the second piece is found, Cass gets wind of what the Wizards 3 and the player characters are doing. Like, Cass always hates Vecna, so he's always looking for a way to screw Vecna over. Now, Mordenkainen has been stuck in the Domain of Dread before, and Cass is coming from the dark powers in the Domain of Dread. Mordenkainen lost his mind when he was stuck in Ravenloft and realized he couldn't deal with Strahd. Like, Strahd is unkillable by Mordenkainen. It sent him in a bad place. It made him very depressed. It put him in a bad spot. So, to me, that means Mordenkainen doesn't like the Domain of Dread. He's not down with the dark powers are stronger than him. He's scared of them. And if he could avoid any one thing in his existence, it would be being sent back there in any way, shape, and or form. So Cass, with the help of the dark powers, knows this. So Cass goes to Mordenkainen with a magical item that Mordenkainen can't counter in any way, shape, or form, because it's from the dark powers, and we already know that Mordenkainen can't deal with the dark powers. And he says, you're going to help me get this Rod of Seven Parts, because I know that's what you're doing, and we're going to go free Mishka the Wolf Spider and kill Vecna, and you're going to help me. And he's going to blackmail him, or he's going to send him to his own Domain of Dread with his Tower of Urd for all eternity. Now, Mordenkainen is there. He's got this really big problem that he has to deal with. He can't really tell anybody, because if he does this, the moment he does, he gets sent to the one place that he doesn't want to go to. Now Cass is part of the adventure. Mordenkainen is part of the adventure. And we have this interesting thriller kind of subplot in the background that the Game Master can use as like a timeline to move things along. That's my thought.
I like that. I'm one of the things that I was thinking too, like, especially, you know, as soon as you see a segment of this takes place in Barovia, I was already trying to think, and I never quite got to it in my outline, but it was like, I wanted to rope Mordenkainen being there or something in there, because there's another weird thing about this is that this version of Tasha is a Tasha from a previous point in time before she has become Igwilv, and it is a little confusing. I think it's mainly to avoid some other place that she appears in 5th edition, so you don't have to explain any of that.
Sure.
But at the same time, if we're going to play with time like that, I thought it might be fun to actually run into Mordenkainen in Barovia and have that be a big clue to the PCs that, wait a minute, if he's here, who have we been talking to?
Yeah, it's a good idea, too. And then you can play around with the idea of time if you wanted to. Maybe this is just Mordenkainen from further down the timeline, because the one that you ran into Barovia is from earlier in the timeline. if you're into time travel stories, it's a really cool way to play with that. I actually like that a lot, Jared. I would do that too, but I also really like time travel stories.
Yeah.
Also, if you want to understand how time travel stories work, go watch the Flash movie and see the scene with Michael Keaton explaining how time messes with things. That is one of the ways that you could do it.
Michael Keaton's the best part of that movie.
He is the best part of that movie. I actually like that movie more than people give it credit for. I thought the end of it was pretty solid.
So my thoughts on The Wizards 3, I might have gone a little bit deeper, but you know, if this is going to be a 50-year commemoration, why not pull in some deep cuts? And they actually do pull in some deep cuts. They just don't live in them quite as much, I think. But my idea for The Wizards 3, and I really did not want to lose Tasha, but at the same time, I kind of like that idea of having at least three different realities represented instead of having two Greyhawk and one Forgotten Realms. So I was thinking you have Elestriel from Forgotten Realms, you have Morden Kanan from Greyhawk, and then you pull in Dunbar Master's Mate from Kryn, which I know some of you won't catch up with that, but that is the white-robed wizard that gave Palin Majer his test in the one novella where Palin becomes the youngest person to have ever taken the test. I know, that was just a whole deep cut in Dragonlance, but still, trust me.
Why not just go with Rastlin? Then you can hit good, neutral, and evil at the same time.
You could. I still feel like Raceland's got too much of a, I will take this entire situation and actually rebuild the universe to my whims kind of air about him.
I think that's great, right? Like, it's a whole other plot point. It depends on how complicated you want your adventure to be.
It is. But I mean, if you want to go with not as much of a deep cut, you could always just go with Dalimar, who was actually in the original Wizards 3.
Yeah, sure. I'm with you. That's a good point. My bad.
No, that's okay. But one of the other things I was thinking was, if we still want Kaz to be somebody that is around this and influencing things, I thought, Elestriel has her wife with her. What if every one of the Wizards 3 just had like a second there, like a bodyguard or an advisor of some sort? You pull in some other characters. Elestriel's got her wife. You give Morden Kanan Lord Robilar, who has been like a traveling companion of his through most of the Greyhawk history. And then
there's a deep cut.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if a bunch of modern 5e players know who Lord Robilar is.
No, but at the very least, it's not like he didn't have some presence in third edition, because there's like a whole adventure about just turning him back to not being evil again towards the end of third edition.
Yeah, yeah.
And then come up with some Knight of Salamnia. If I went with Dunbar, I would have brought Reva's Silverblade from the Dragonlance comics in there just to, you know, have a Knight of Salamnia involved in there too.
I mean, you're playing with time travel. You can just throw Sturm in there. It's okay.
That's true too. I'm trying not to make people think too much about, is this breaking something? But yes, you definitely could do that, especially if you do start playing with time and having Morden Kanan stuck in Barovia and everything.
Both options are reasonable. Mm-hmm. I mean, as soon as you say time travel and taking people from different points in time, you can do whatever you want.
Oh, yeah.
Now we're really playing in the idea of the multiverse, which is fine. I also like your idea a lot too, right? Like, those are all really, every one of those options is perfectly good options depending on the context.
Once you have like Robilar as like Morden Kanan's bodyguard that's hanging out with him, his old adventuring buddy, Robilar makes so much more sense for Kaz to be impersonating. He's like a general and a fighter and, you know, is renowned for his combat ability. And that's Kaz. Kaz was a general.
He could play the part really well.
So, I mean, that was my thought for the.
Yeah, it's a great idea. In doing this, a couple of other things happen. One, you have a pretty powerful secret, which is Morden Kanan's secret. Or Robilar's secret, if you're using whatever version that we just talked about you're using, the secret change. There's a secret that changes. And then there's a new secret that you can add to the game, which is a more interesting, I think, secret, because it's been there the entire time and it's very connected to what the player characters are dealing with. And then you have to figure out the reveal part, like how you're going to pull it off. I still think that you can use Melania to be the suspicious one. That's Elestriel's wife. And she's going to figure out that something's off with whoever the person is, and then they're going to go off to do something at some point, and she's going to follow them, and then Elestriel is going to say to the player characters, look, I'm really busy, but my wife is missing for longer than she normally is. Can you go find her? I think she's here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could still play that point. And I kept thinking, like, why wouldn't she just go find her herself? I'm like, oh, because they're trying to keep all these other cults of Vecna from sending energy off, so they're constantly doing stuff. And I think that's an important plot point for the story. whatever the player characters are doing, the Wizards 3 need to be doing stuff.
Yes.
And they need to be mustering other parties. You need to have something like reports coming back in, like about other things that are happening in the multiverse. This can't be like a one front war. It's a war is what it is. That's my thought.
If we're going to touch on that aspect of the Wizards 3, that is a problem that I had kind of recurring with this, because the Wizards 3 sit there and send you to a place, and then you come back and they send you to another place. And there's no indication that they're doing anything other than waiting for you to come back and then head back out again. And yes, I think they need to be doing something active. And the other thing that bothers me about a lot of this is they just know stuff. They know everything about a topic and then tell you about it. So you just, it's weird to me that you have no characters that are from Eberron, but they can spout a bunch of Eberron knowledge to you.
Well, I could buy that Mordenkainen's been to Eberron.
I can, but I mean, it doesn't even say, though, that they've been there. They just like say they tell you this about Eberron.
Well, you should just say that you're right. Right. So we need to set this up, which is Mordenkainen has that tower that can travel the planes.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably been everywhere and seen everything. You can even say that Tasha has been everywhere and seen everything, too, in the same way. Elustriel, I don't know that Elustriel's, is she a planewalker? Like, does she run around? There's a magic card of her as a planewalker, isn't there?
It's kind of implied that all of the Chosen of Mystra, like, defend Toril from outside threats. But there are a lot less stories of her just, like, randomly roaming the plains than there are, like, Elminster or Kelbin or some of those characters that actually do have, like, fortresses on other planes of existence and things like that.
So maybe not her, but the other two can totally be fonts of information about that, especially if you set it up by saying, well, this one time I was here, and then add some flavor from that space.
Yeah, that is definitely a better way to present that.
So you can actually mention, like, oh, yeah, I ran into Dunbar this one time. He's a pretty nice guy. A little bit stodgy for me, but, you know, just stuff like that. If you do that, that's, you need one line to make that make sense, essentially.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the stuff in this, is that it's missing a little bit of connective tissue, and it wouldn't take a lot of connective tissue to make some of this smooth out a lot more.
Sure, but I understand page counts.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in published books, the book is already pretty big.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're talking about this. I bet some of this stuff was probably, like, left on the cutting room floor to get down to, like, what is the bare minimum that people need to run this thing?
Yeah.
That's me throwing that out there.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you want to go next?
Well, before we moved on, I also wanted to, this kind of dovetails something else I wanted to talk about, but when you're mentioning that about Mordenkainen and that having that blackmail secret, that touches on something that the secrets need to be more like secrets in this. There's a few that are, but a lot of them are just like, I haven't had a chance to tell this person this important thing yet. And that's not a secret. That's just, you haven't been able to tell them that yet. Some of them just don't have a lot of impact. Like, in the beginning, since we're doing spoilers, you have an NPC that knows that Lord Neverember, he knows for sure that he is not descended from the royal line of Neverwinter. That's a good secret.
Yes.
A lot of them don't live up to that one.
Yeah. The other two are about Vecna, which are interesting also. Those are also good secrets. The first chapter is really good. That's they took some time with that one. It's very thematic. If you read that, then you're like, oh yeah, I get what this adventure is all about. Secrets and cults and all that good stuff.
So yeah, I would just take some time and put a little bit more of a hard edge on some of the secrets, to where it's like, it is something someone does not want to tell someone, not just that they haven't had a chance to, but something that is a failing on their part or a failing on one of their loved ones' parts that they don't want to share with someone, even though it would be better if they did. And then they feel more like actual secrets.
Yes, I agree with you. Make them poignant, make them devastating, like secrets should be devastating. Do it all, man. Make it bad. Bad as you can. And make it that if they find out that maybe somebody doesn't want them to know that and will come after them. That is one of those things about secrets.
I think the other thing I was going to bring up, because I tried to tie these things together, it does strike me that for as much as we're talking about the Wizards 3 not doing anything, if you are talking about someone that has ascended to godhood that is going to rewrite the entire multiverse in his image, there is a surprising lack of gods that are getting involved in this on any level.
Yeah, so why do you think that is?
I mean, from an adventure design standpoint, you don't want a god to show up and just say, okay, I am ending this, you know, because given godly power levels, you know, maybe somebody could, or maybe a whole bunch of people could show up and just blast Vecna out of, you know, this aspect of the multiverse or something. But it strikes me that if he is a god of secrets, then maybe you should find a way for the gods to not know that this is going on.
And then mention that somewhere. Or maybe the gods did find out, but they can't affect him where he is. So that they're the ones that told the Wizards Three to do something about it. That's enough, actually. If you did that, that's plenty.
One of my favorite parts in this is there is a part when you are in Avernus where you could end up confronted by Tiamat. There is this kind of feeling like, oh, crap, this is Tiamat. What are we going to do? And Tiamat's basically like, I don't want Vecna rewriting the universe. Go ahead. Just get out of here.
That would be a great scene, right? Mm. Like, I mean, I don't like you and I would eat you, but you're, you know, positioned better than I am to do something about this. I think that's the thing about gods, right? They don't have as much freedom to do what they want to do as sometimes we give them credit for. They're very much bound to their portfolios and their domains and the planes of existence that they're stuck in. So while they have all this power, they have like an itty bitty living space.
It is interesting that if you read how they frame Vecna in this, in order for you to be able to fight him so you're not fighting a god, they mention that he kind of strips himself of his divinity in order to do this ritual, which kind of plays back into what you were saying. Maybe he could not do this as a god.
There you go. Right. So you just take that piece and just expand upon it.
Like, explain why, other than that you don't want your PCs fighting a god, but you're okay with them fighting a lich.
Yeah. And these are things that you can write down that you don't need to like exposition dump all at once. They can be part of the mystery of Vecna, of how he is getting done what he needs to get done. It leads into the other artifacts that exist in this particular game and what you can do with them.
The other thing I was going to say, too, though, when it comes to maybe not having the gods know anything, it's a good segue into the artifacts, is they never, like, after all this time teasing us with the obelisks that were set up by Vecna, that were in all of these adventures in 5th edition, they don't show up in this at all.
I don't know. It's a miss, right?
What I was thinking is, what if those obelisks are shielding him? If someone finds out about something, those obelisks just kind of like suck the, you know, the knowledge of it out of their heads.
Sure, but as soon as you do that, then you can go and destroy the obelisks, and that's a lot more work for the person running the adventure to put together adventures to do stuff like that, I would think. Maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Can you think of a way to do that quickly? Like, to make that a plot point? Maybe discovering it's the thing, and then the Wizards 3 can send their other ancillary forces to go deal with those obelisks.
I think this is one of those things where it depends on what your audience is. Is this, if you're running this for people that haven't played any of the other 5th edition adventures, this is going to play differently. But if they have played those, and they have had DMs that pointed out these weird obelisks that just keep showing up in all these adventures, they don't need to encounter any of them. They just need the Wizards 3 to point out, oh, these obelisks that have shown up in multiple planes of existence and, you know, multiple worlds. Yeah, that's what Vecna's using to, you know, hide what he's doing. And then it is almost like it's like closure for them for all of those other 5th edition adventures that they have played.
Yeah, but come on, you know players, right? As soon as you say that, they're going to be like, we should go destroy those things. Then we'll know where he is.
True. But whatever I was thinking about, whether people know about this or not, I did kind of like the idea that maybe the reason that the PCs are special and can reach Vecna and are part of this is that when they're tracking down that cult in the beginning, they find the eye of Vecna, and the Wizards 3 have the hand of Vecna. And that's why they can all operate a little bit more freely than anybody else in the multiverse at this point.
Yeah, I like that. That's a cool idea. I want to touch on your obelisk thing again for a second. I actually kind of, now I'm synthesizing this thought in my head. I like this idea where part of the reveal of Cass and whatnot, and some of that is finding out about the obelisks. Like, you got to put that plot point in there somewhere. You can seed it in some of these adventures. Maybe just, you can probably just drop an obelisk in one of these places and it being reinforced, and then have some cultist that you can convince to tell you what's going on with them. And at that point, you can go back to the Wizards 3 and tell them, look, these obelisks are hiding Vecna. So then the Wizards 3 can send all of these other forces that are out there that they have dealing with these cults and trying to stop what's going on, to slow down Vecna while you do the thing that you're doing. And then you can have a bunch of cuts to those different places, especially if you played all those other adventures with the obelisks, to adventurers showing up and destroying the obelisks, which then allows you to then go to Pandemonium to get Vecna.
Yeah.
That's such a cool, like, cinematic third act thing. Like, We don't know where he is. We can't find him. Oh, we can find him now. Let's go get him.
And this is something they could not do in the adventure, but something you can do in your home game. If you remember all of the other PCs that you have run this for, and if some of them are at your table, if you describe their other adventuring parties going to destroy those obelisks, that is a great capstone.
So good. So good. I mean, you made me think of that when you said that before, like the capstone of the campaign. Like, oh man, what if your other characters went and destroyed them? That's actually what I was thinking. It's good. That's good. No, I do like the idea of the hand and the Eye of Vecna making you also special. Like, you show up and then, like, you get the Eye of Vecna at the beginning. Then you have the problem of, do you use it or not, right? Like, oh, God.
My thought, too, was, like, maybe there is, like, a containment vessel. Like, as long as you're not tempted to open this thing, you know what's going on, but the eye is safe. It's not going to start whispering or anything, as long as you don't open that little box that the eye is
in. We already talked about the Rod of Seven Parts. I don't think we need to talk about that, right?
No.
We should talk about the Book of Vile Darkness, though. You do have that in here, and I think it's a good idea to slide this into the game.
It is really interesting that when, like, what was it, 2 years ago when they showed that new artwork of Vecna, there was this really neat part of that artwork that I loved, which is they designed it to where inside his rib cage he can store the Book of Vile Darkness.
It's pretty cool, right?
And unfortunately, it doesn't make it into this adventure. And if you don't know, part of it is of the lore of this is that Vecna wrote the original Book of Vile Darkness. So, I mean, this is yet another Vecna-related artifact. And I like the idea that maybe part of this adventure is keeping Vecna from getting the Book of Vile Darkness because that is going to bolster him somehow. And one of the things that's interesting about that is there is actually an adventure in Keys from the Golden Vault that is about infiltrating this Ifrit's fortress and stealing the Book of Vile Darkness so that no one else can have it. Keys from the Golden Vault even mentions that you can throw rival adventuring parties into some of these heists. And this would be a great time to have like a rival group of Vecna cultists working against you trying to steal this thing too.
I would slot this right in the middle of the campaign. I really would. I would put it between pieces 3 and 4 of the rod, getting the rod. If you stuck it right there, if they win and they get the book, awesome. But you can make it hard and make it the lose condition that they lose the book. And when they lose the book, then everything gets worse. If that happens, like the cultists come, they have different powers than they had before. You can just shift some things because the book now exists in the world and Vecna has it.
Yeah, it's not an automatic I win for him, but it's also bad if he gets it.
Yeah, and then you can, like you have in the notes, Jared, you could make him stronger at the end because he has the book in his chest. And it's a thing to like get the book out of his chest is like one of the things you have to do in order to defeat him. Oh man, that's a great idea. Just give him more powers. Just make it worse. It's just, he's already got like a CR26. Just make it worse. It's like 500 temporary hit points with the Book of Vile Darkness in his chest. But, you know, beating through those is almost impossible. So you have to like go run up to him and rip the book out of his chest in order to make that not be a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I blame the artwork because it looked really cool to have like a container inside his rib cage to store the book.
I do not mean that he should have 500 temporary hit points. I mean, maybe he should. Yes. I don't know. And then if you rip the book out of his chest, he loses them all. Like, that's a great, it's just, it creates a moment.
If you want to play with some mechanics that Wizards has not played with a lot since they introduced them, you could have the Book of Vile Darkness turn Vecna into a mythic monster to where, you know, you get to him to a certain point and then he transforms and you're fighting a different version of him after you beat him down to, you know, the first time.
I mean, I love JRPG mechanics in my D&D game. I use them all the time. It's a great, great idea.
Yep.
All right. What else we got? You got the adventures now, the individual adventures.
Yeah. There are some things in the individual adventures that I kind of wish they would have fine tuned a little bit. Ravenloft wasn't too bad. Ravenloft, the only thing about that is I kind of wish that they had played up, not even so much in the Ravenloft adventure, but they would have played up that the Dark Powers sent Vecna to go, or not Vecna, sent Kaz to go do this. Because there's a throwaway line that mentions that, you know, they're whispering in his ear. And the idea that, you know, Dark Lords don't just randomly leave the Domains of Dread.
It's true.
So there is this idea that the Dark Powers want Vecna back. And I wish they would have played with that a little bit more. It doesn't have to have a lot of weight, but it has to get mentioned. Like, if it's something that the DM is reading and the players never hear, it's a cool plot point that doesn't matter.
My whole Rod of Seven Parts story is based on the fact that Kaz has the dark powers on his side and he's going to use the Rod of Seven Parts to imprison him. Where? The Domains of Dread. Like, where else are you going to put him? That's where I would put him.
Mm-hmm.
Throwing it out there.
Oh, yeah. I try so hard not to get too fiddly with my Dragonlance thing, but it does kind of bug me that in the Dragonlance adventure, you go there and you're allying yourself with a group of friendly lycanthropes, which, if you are a longtime person that has played in Dragonlance, there are really not lycanthropes in Kryn. And this isn't like me being like a deep canon wonk saying this is horrible and it goes against the spirit of Dragonlance or anything. It's more of a practical thing. The reason they don't use lycanthropes in Kryn is because they don't want to deal with the fact that there are three moons.
Makes sense.
I was a little bit more interested in having it be, you go there during the middle of the War of the Lance. I would love if this was some renegade. They're not working for the dragon armies. They're not working for, you know, they're not, you know, a member of the Orders of High Sorcery. They're just a renegade that is going to try and crash Lunatari into Kryn because why not? You know, this entire world is screwed anyway. I am going to make my mark on it by destroying everything. In that case, it is something where this is happening off to the side of the War of the Lance instead of, you know, trying to, you know, slot it back in. There's also this whole thing where it's a moon dragon, which moon dragons don't really have any lore that ties into Dragonlance other than that the name Moon is involved and Dragonlance has three moons. So moons are what we're mooning over here. So
sorry.
But there is some lore about how there were chromatic and metallic dragons that basically said, screw you, we're not fighting this war. And they were cursed. I think the dragon that mentors this renegade should be one of those dragons and not a moon dragon.
Yeah, I'm that sounds great. I'm going to do it.
And the other this one is just a weird thing to me is that there's a bunch of people that are trapped in a temple and they're trapped by this enormous CR-15 wolf thing. And you throw a piece of fruit at it to distract it so that people can get out of the temple.
Oh, a wolf? I didn't read this part. So you're going to help me out here.
I mean, it is not technically a wolf, but it is a CR-15 huge creature that looks like a wolf.
So we should be throwing at a cow.
I'm just saying there's nothing really thematic about Dragonlance that says that there are wolves of unusual size in the setting. I don't know why this isn't like a dragon or something that is keeping them penned in there.
Yeah, it's a weird adventure, right? For being Kryn, like, why would we go with wolves when you have dragons? So let's just take a step back. These lycanthropes, they're not werewolves. They're probably were-dragons. They're like draconians or been infected with draconian blood. That's why they're cursed, right? That's probably a better story. And then we just sub the wolf out for a dragon. I mean, I mean, we just, every time there's a wolf, just sub in dragon. I don't know, man. I don't see why we wouldn't just do that.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing you can do there. There were some things, like even in third edition, where they're talking about if you really want lycanthropes, you can have them. They are not officially in the setting, but make it a curse that is triggered by something other than the moon. But even then, you kind of want to come up with why are they cursed this way? Because this isn't a normal thing that happens. You know, they aren't like normally occurring creatures.
There's an easy fix for that. We'll just use the gargoyles methodology. Whenever the sun goes down, they shift. Whenever the sun comes up, they shift back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why it has to be tied to the moons at all in any way, shape, and or form. I also like the idea that they're were-dragons. I mean, we need more were-dragons in the world. Just throwing that one out there.
I mean, and that could even be tied to another one of these, like, could be like a renegade chromatic dragon that doesn't want to play by the rules, that is tinkering with some mortals and giving them some of its power.
Yeah, and we're already dealing, I mean, the draconians, they're around during the War of the Lance, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my Dragonlance knowledge is, I mean, I've read the seven books that exist, and that was like 30 years ago at this point. It was like 15, so like 30 years ago. So the curse could be that they shift into a draconian-like form. I think that's a cool idea. And that the weird giant wolf thing, the Bordak or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Is just a mutated draconian that came out of the egg wrong.
Yeah.
Because the draconians come out of eggs. So, like, the dragon eggs have been corrupted by Takesis. So, you know, just have one that went the wrong way, and now it's just this kind of, like, siege monster dragon. I don't see why that's a problem. It seems kind of interesting to me. That's where I'm at with all of this for Kryn. Like, I'm with you. If you're not dragon-theming it, I don't know what you're doing here.
Yeah, I just it just struck me as odd, and it wasn't, like I said, it's very easy for someone like me that knows too much about the setting to get very wonky about what I wish they would do. But it also just doesn't feel like it was very much like Dragonlance. It felt like, oh, Dragonlance has three moons. There are moons. Everything is about moons here.
Yeah, and you can still do the moon thing with that because the moons do matter, mm-hmm. right? Like the red moon, the blue moon, and the white moon, yeah. right? They matter quite a lot to the setting mm-hmm. and how magic works. Then you have both of the themes going together, and you might have to rewrite a few things, but you have dragons, and then you have moon stuff with moon magic, because that matters to the Dragonlance setting also.
Yeah.
I don't know why you have to tie lycanthropes to it. That doesn't feel very Dragonlance to me, but that's just me.
No, it was just strange. That was probably one of the biggest things that jumped out as kind of hitting a weird note for me as far as any of the individual adventures. On the other hand, I really liked the Greyhawk one.
Yeah.
The Greyhawk one felt very Greyhawk to me.
Why did it feel very Greyhawk to you?
Despite the fact that it's happening on this isle, there is actually a history in the setting for this isle and how there was like a serpent cult there. And, you know, the people were driven off of the place because Acererac had created some tomb there. And because there was that whole history of no one knows if there's still people living there. And the story is that they're trying to reestablish the city that they used to live there. It's like picking up threads. And I liked it. And also it's Acererac. And he's making this stupid tomb that kills people that walk into it because that's what a Acererac does.
Yeah, that's about right. That's how he collects souls. We all know that now, so, you know.
The other thing that I actually loved about it was the actual villain is not a Acererac. It is a simulacrum of a Acererac that has named itself Rerac. And that sounds silly, but it is also 100% Greyhawk.
I mean, there's also a great blue devil face inside of it. So, you know,
yes.
this adventure's got all kinds of wind to it, right? This section.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, there's a Kraken. This is like some sword and sorcery garbage going on right here. And I mean garbage in the best way, right? Like, this
oh, yeah.
Dungeon crawling, sword and sorcery fun, essentially.
There's also a weird thing, like when you go back to the realms, because you start off in the graveyard in Neverwinter. When you go back, you are breaking up this group of Lolth's followers, and they almost go too much out of their way to make sure there are no drow in this organization.
That's weird.
Yeah, I get wanting to decouple the idea that drow are born evil or that all drow follow Lolth. I get all that. But after 50 years, it's kind of weird to have an entire organization dedicated to Lolth where there are no drow that are working for her here.
I'm going to say the name wrong. Elestray, whatever the heck her name is.
Oh, yeah. Elestray, yeah.
Yeah, we have her. I mean, we have all of those folks too, right?
Yeah.
Like the drow that fall under that banner. I mean, not all drow are evil these days. It's just, I mean, Dristoord and Destroyed started the train on that one, and now we have tons of drow characters that are not evil. Plus, player characters running around with two scimitars and a panther.
Definitely. But I mean, what was interesting about that adventure too is it's implied that you should either sneak through this fortress or disguise yourself. But there's no way to really tell your players that unless you just say you should sneak through this fortress or disguise yourself, because that's what this adventure assumes.
Time to make the idea roll.
Yeah, and I thought it would actually be kind of neat if you had some drow followers of Elestray that are scoping this place out, and when you arrive, they go, hey, if you want to get in there, we'll share some information with you, but you probably want to disguise yourself or sneak around.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Plus, we can help you. Like, we have somebody on the inside already. That's your contact.
Mm-hmm.
That is a much better story beat for that. Plus, if you want to introduce them, you just have Elestray say, this is my contact here. Mm-hmm. Talk to them first. They'll help you.
Yeah.
Then the Wizards 3 did something for you, which feels good.
Yes.
Like, I can't stand it when my superiors don't do anything.
Yes. There was a weird, you know, speaking of the Wizards 3 and having them do something, there was a plot point that came up in Rime of the Ice Maiden where they were talking about the obelisks, and they actually start telling you a little bit more about the obelisks, and they go into the Weavers, which in other editions were known as the Spell Weavers. And if you've never heard of those, this isn't just me doing a deep cut. It was actually in Rime of the Frost Maiden.
I'm making this face because they're not great.
No, but they are like these bug-like things that can cast multiple spells at one point in time. But their whole backstory is everything used to be one plane of existence. and they want to merge everything back into being one plane of existence. And in some ways, they are like the antithesis of Vecna, because Vecna has done things in the past that has caused planes to split off into alternate versions of themselves, and they don't like Vecna. My idea was, in you could have the Wizards 3 trying to keep the Weavers from turning everything into one reality while Vecna is weakening it, while you're trying to stop Vecna from rewriting everything.
That's a heavy lift for the adventure, but it's not a bad idea. I like it. Mm-hmm. I would have to like write like a 2 or 3 page thing off to the right of what they're actually doing as a secondary faction.
Yeah.
And trying to accomplish this, and how, what their methodology is for doing it. What do you think their methodology would be doing that is then, if we're going to talk about this? You brought this up. This is your fault.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. I, for one thing, I think they might be messing with those obelisks too. That might be one of the things where it's like, they are, because these things are all connected to Vecna and he is weakening the multiverse to rewrite it, they are going to all of these obelisks and trying to siphon power off of them to condense everything back into one plane of existence again.
All right. So now we need to talk about where we can drop an obelisk or two into these different adventures.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling that you can't drop one into the Death House one. The dark powers aren't allowing that, right?
No, that'd be really weird.
The Lambert Zenith Last Voyage, that won't be tricky too, although you could have one near that,
yeah,
in the Astral Sea on like the body of a dead god, because, you know, we need, that's always fun to do. That makes sense. Something that helps collect secrets out in the astral plane. The Ruined Colossus one, that one's easy. You could just drop that anywhere in and around that space.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a big open valley in the Mornlands in Eberron. It's real easy to just have an obelisk in the middle of nowhere out there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Plus, anything, you could even add another encounter in there of something terrible from the Mornland that's been infused with secrets, like secret power. Like, oh, God, I wonder what that would look like.
Oh, man.
A corpse collector that whispers secrets, maddening secrets. It's like a gibbering mouther, but worse. I mean, it's really like a Shoggoth, if you want, you know, the truth.
Yeah.
In the Tomb of Wayward Souls, that's easy. You can just be somewhere on the island. Not a problem. I feel like there probably wouldn't be one in Avernus. I don't know that. I mean, maybe if he hid one. I mean, if he hid one somewhere in Avernus, you could stick it down there somewhere.
Maybe, but yeah, that would be one where if you didn't want to put it, that would be one to skip. I think the other, when we were talking about Dragonlance, the place where that renegade wizard is at is like this,
yep,
shrine to all three moons, and it'd be super easy to have an obelisk in that shrine, too.
You could also have it near the tree that's dying, and maybe the thing that's actually
true.
Killing the tree. Well, I mean, I think there's something else.
Oh, yeah.
But you just shift that a little bit. That'd be fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So there's places that you could do that to put those. And then with that, these spell weavers, they could just show up at these places doing something to these obelisks. Cause like and then if you interact with them, maybe you can find something out about them. Like the first time you talk to them, maybe they try to recruit you. The second time, maybe they, since you've now not recruited them, like they decide to try to kill you, or they do something else, and then they become wary of you. Then they try to find out about you. Then they start chasing you. The way that a clock would work in a game, like this is, yeah, an escalating thing. It's just another thing to track. That's all.
The other thing is, too, if you have them showing up around these obelisks, you can also turn that into another thing where this is what the Wizards 3 are doing. When you get back, you tell them, yes, they showed up at this place. Okay, we'll go back in. We'll tag back in and take care of that. Now that you got the rod piece, this is where you need to go next.
Yeah, right. And then we'll be like, well, we'll have other people go look into these obelisks. And then over the course of time, you can learn more and more about the obelisks until, oh, man, that's really good. Learn more and more about the obelisks until you get to the end when they're like, we know what these things do. We're going to send all of the rest of our forces. Be ready to go wherever we need to send you right away, because we don't know where to send you yet.
Mm-hmm.
Then you don't even necessarily need the cast reveal, but you can still have him around and he could still be a wild card instead of being the,
yeah,
primary driver of the plot. I like the idea that he's not necessarily the primary driver of the plot.
Yeah.
I like that he's a wild card character that wants something. I want to kill Vecna. And my methodology for killing Vecna is to steal the Rod of Seven Parts, free Mishka the Wolf Spider, and then together we will kill Vecna.
Yeah.
All these stories together, it's more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Everything we're saying makes this more complicated. And the reason that this stuff isn't in the book, because the page count just went up 100 pages.
Yeah, definitely. I absolutely agree. I mean, part of what I would like for the Planescape portion of this is, instead of having a portal in Elestriel's Sanctum that just sends you to whatever world, I think it would be really neat for them to be telling you, okay, you're in Sigil, here is your portal key, go to this section, find this doorway and go through there. And that's how you go to each of these worlds.
Yep. And then Sigil becomes like your home base.
Yeah.
In reality. And you can wander around the city and make connections with folks. And that's where your market is. And that's where you can buy stuff. And anything can come through the plains.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything comes to Sigil, the City of Doors.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, if you have the old second edition Planescape box, then you have that giant map of Sigil that you just lay out on the board and just be like, hey, circle that. That's where Elustrial's sanctum is. And then you can just start circling and dotting places. So when you get bored of having these adventures as a game master or as the or dungeon master, sorry, wrong show, those adventures out in the plains, you can have like a city adventure. Heck, you can even shift the keys from the Golden Vault adventure from being in there to being somewhere mm-hmm. in Sigil if you want. Just have it in a Freet's Palace in Sigil.
Oh, yeah.
All of these things can connect. This is one of the cool things about these D&D adventure books, is that once you start thinking about them a little bit, you can modify them in a bunch of different ways with not too much work, just asking yourself a few questions of how to get there, and maybe sitting down with a friend and talking about it, and you can get to a lot of cool things.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, it's just going one layer deeper.
Yep. Do you want to talk about this final confrontation before we finish this up?
Yeah, I think so. So I'm not super thrilled with Pandemonium, and the only reason that I'm not super thrilled with Pandemonium being the final location is because this is about unmaking the entire universe and rebuilding it, and it feels like there would be a better place to rip the universe apart and put it back together again. But as we've been talking about, I think there should be like an obelisk in Pandemonium that goes to Vecna's Fortress. Vecna's Fortress has traditionally been in like the... It was one of the quasi-elemental planes between like the negative plane and everything. Basically, if you go to his fortress, you're going to die because it's going to be draining your life force out of you. I would put Vecna's fortress in the elemental chaos, which is where all of the elemental planes bleed together. And that feels like a good place to, you know, break the universe and rebuild it. You're right there by the elemental planes where everything's built from.
I could dig that. It seems reasonable to me. That I got no critique for that. The only reason I like Pandemonium is because Mishka the Wolf Spider's there, so you have all of these terrible things all in one space.
Yeah, and that's why I was thinking, you know, you have the obelisk that leads, like, you can't get to his citadel unless you go through that obelisk, so you still have to deal with, you know, being in Pandemonium. That's still the way to get to him. It's just not quite as direct as him doing it on the plane.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I also think you mentioned this before, that you have a good story with the rod, with it just being a thing that has imprisoned people before. But even in the adventure, you can break these barriers. And basically, Vecna has these barriers that are proto universes that he has started to imagine, which is neat in and of itself.
Cool, yeah.
Yes.
I particularly like the one where he's usurped all of the powers of every other god.
Yeah.
It's pretty solid.
You already have that. And one of the two things, like, you can break it one way, or you can touch one of those with the Rod of Seven Parts and it unravels the demiplane. So I'm thinking, like, that's the reason they wanted you to have the Rod of Seven Parts, because you can unravel all these demiplanes that he's protecting himself with.
Makes perfect sense. It is a implement of order, and this is obviously chaos at this point, right?
Yeah.
These shattered reflections are not the real world, and they conflict with what the real world should be. So shattering them with the Rod of Seven Parts makes perfect sense.
The other thing is it's a shortcut towards the end, but it's like, because you're linked to Vecna, once you're ready to go to him, you can just go to him. And that's kind of why I like that idea of the obelisk, because then it's not just the power has been within us all the time, because, you know, that kind of feels like,
yes, it's bad. I don't think that's a great story beat, but that's, you know,
no,
maybe somebody else does like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that person.
I can't help but throw my deep cuts in there, but you have two like random drow that are not with Lolth that want this cloak back when you get to Pandemonium. And I really wanted to make it like Lyriel and Shalara, who's this other elf that hangs out with her. And if you haven't heard of Lyriel, she's the other good drow that was around in third edition. And you should probably read all of her books because they were excellent.
A question for you, because like I said, I've only been able to skim through a lot of this stuff. Where do you get the Chime of Exile?
Right off the bat, they mention the Chime of Exile. And before you go to fight Vecna, well, actually, trying to remember, there's a point at which they basically just hand it to you and say, here.
Yeah. So let's just merge the Chime of Exile with the Rod of Seven Parts.
Yeah.
We were eliminating thing that you need, making the Rod more important, which it's been important to the entire scenario. So why not just do that?
If you haven't read the adventure, basically the Chime of Exile is you need to get someone to like 50% of their hit points, and then you can ring it and banish them. And that's fine, but you could do the same thing, like Chris was saying, with the rod.
I mean, it's Vecna. You throw down with Vecna, that's always a good time.
Bringing this full circle, that could be one of the things that if he has the Book of Vile Darkness in him, that he can't have the Book of Vile Darkness for you to use this on him. So you have to get the Book of Vile Darkness and have him below 50% of his hit points in order to be able to use this.
It's just below 50 hit points, but that's okay. I'm with you. Right.
That
makes more sense anyway. Yeah. Below 50 hit points. I mean, I would even make it worse. Be like, you have to reduce him to 0 hit points and then hit him with the staff or the rod to make to banish him.
Mm-hmm.
No, to imprison him in the domain of dread, his own domain of dread. It'll be cute for him. He'll get to live there for until, you know, the next 10 years elapse. And then we have another Vecna adventure.
It is really interesting, too, though. They specifically say when you banish him, you banish him to Greyhawk.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know if maybe this ties into how they're going to present Greyhawk in the Dungeon Master's Guide.
Sure. That's fine. Just have the rod banish him to Greyhawk then.
Yeah.
Either way, it just has the banishment spell on it when you knock somebody down to 0 hit points or whatever. I don't know why they put the 50 hit point thing in there. Just like when you knock him to 0, it banishes him. Because maybe because 0 is always like so associated with death. I don't know.
Yeah. It was, it's kind of a weird thing. And yeah, the chime is probably not really needed. It's funny for all of the other artifacts that they kind of excised from this, and then they add that in and it doesn't really do that much. So
I do like these like reflection planes that exist though.
They're
they're really cool. They do a great job of pulling back in some of the places that you've been to already, which is pretty fun. So like that's a solid ending for the scenario, these different locations and whatnot.
There is a weird thing in this adventure where if you manage to find out that Kaz is actually Mordenkainen, which you don't really have much of an opportunity to do until like right before he steals the Rod of Seven Parts and runs to Pandemonium. But if you don't let him take the rod, which is usually just because your character said, no, you can't have this. We're carrying this with us all the time. But if you do that, it tells you to just skip to the end when you're fighting Vecna. And that feels a little anticlimactic, but there is a nice thing that they do, because one of the demiplanes that Vecna is imagining is actually a demiplane that is just torturing Kaz.
Yep.
So it's kind of a neat way to at least bookend that storyline with Kaz, even if you didn't have him steal the rod.
Plus, then you can have Kaz, this version of Kaz, when he's there, like profess his love for Vecna if you want, which I'm a proponent of. I need a little tragic love story in my fantasy adventure.
Oh. Man, that should definitely be one of the demi planes, is showing them when they were together and making their initial plans and everything.
Oh man, slide that in there. That's a good thought.
Yeah.
I just really like the idea. That idea that it's just a love story gone wrong.
Oh, absolutely. And that gives you a perfect reason, like if you have this as one of the demi planes, to show that picture from the book to your PCs to say, this is what you're seeing in this, you know, in this demi plane that he is imagining.
It's a fight with Vecna at the end, I don't know. you should make it epic. There's a lot of ways to make it epic. It's just in a room, right? Like, it's not even that big of a room.
Yeah.
This is disappointing, okay? I'm a little disappointed. This is what I would do. Every time he gets reduced to a certain threshold, I would have the reality around him shift to one of these demiplanes that he's like, these reflection planes. So there's all these maps, and it's a bit much, and it'd probably be not the easiest thing in the world to prepare, but at least then you're going back through each of these like locations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, they gave you the maps and whatnot, or you can even like, maybe not Sigil, it's Sigil. That's we figured that out from somebody actually for reals, because the Lady of Pain will wreck your face. But maybe he like sets the ritual, potentially even partially sets the ritual off, and it starts doing the thing, but it like flings you all across the plains and you're fighting in these different locations. So to have like 3 or 4 maps, like you're fighting on Krim by that tree, you're fighting on that ship in the Astral Sea.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's what I would do.
Yeah, I love that. That is neat. That is a nice idea.
Well, I mean, it also is thematic to the what's going on here, right? Like, that's what the fight should feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Do not let him get murdered in 2 rounds. it's got to be more than that, man. Like, you haven't done all of this just for that. I mean, it's Vecna.
And, you know, honestly, if you're going to give... And I hate to use this term, because I think as a DM, you should probably have in your mind what you won't let people do and what you will. So it's not arbitrary. But if you're going to give any villain plot armor, it is the final boss of a 20th level adventure that is the capstone of this kind of campaign.
Yeah, I mean, he's got 5 legendary resistances and he doesn't have enough hit points. Give him some more hit points.
No.
He's got 272. He probably needs like 472. And these are 20th level characters. They're going to wreck his face.
Yeah.
I'm just letting you know. Like, he can dread counterspell and he can do stuff. He's got three reactions, but only one per turn. So that's fine. He can counterspell three times. That's probably useful. He's got that vile teleport. I just like the idea of just blasting people through these different realities and then you're disoriented when you get there.
It might even be neat. Like, I would not do this to where someone has to actually change their stats. But if you explained that the PCs actually physically look like what they would look like in a different reality once in a while.
Yeah, right? All right, now that I'm synthesizing this thought right here, I would give him 150 hit points four times.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he gets reduced to 150 hit points, the map changes because he blasts you through reality and you're in a different reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just continue the fight, right? So maybe somebody whacks him for 150 in one shot. Probably not. Maybe they do, though. I mean, somebody smites him.
Yeah.
You know, with a giant smite, that's a lot of damage. Or somebody backstabs him, that's a lot of damage.
Especially if they get a crit.
Correct. that's 150 hit points right away, out of the way. But yeah, like, I don't want this thing to feel anticlimactic.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff surrounding the space that he's in. Like, there's all those doorways that you have to get through, too, and that's part of... They're considering that part of the boss fight, but they have to write inside of a space that they're forced to write in for these D&D adventures.
Yeah.
It would be very difficult for them to explain the thing that I just said that you could do.
Yeah.
The stat block doesn't support it. All the things that I am mentioning don't support it. These are different kinds of, like, modifications to the base D&D. So that's why it's not in there. I bet they probably wanted something like that, which is why they have those reflections.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the best way that they could figure it out of what I was just saying.
Mm-hmm.
But man, how much cooler would it be if you were fighting Vecna in all those spaces?
The other thing that I was thinking that you could do is you have the reality that you're in shift as a lair action whenever it triggers.
Yeah, right? I'm with you, right? That's a great idea too.
But the thing about having the PCs change who they are in this reality would also be a nice bookend for all of your players that had played through the Planescape adventure, even if it's not directly tied to that, because part of that was alternate versions of yourself from different realities.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's a simple enough add, too. All you do is whenever you change realities, you ask the question, what about you is slightly different from what was there before physically? Because you might even be still the same person. Or you could even ask a question like, what memory of yours is different right now from your past?
Yeah.
That simple question nails down the fact that you are the same but different.
Mm-hmm.
These are all cool ideas. I would use all of this stuff in the final confrontation with Vecna. It would be like a 2.5 hour, 3 hour fight, because that's usually what stuff like this ends up being. And it would be fun. I don't know. I think it'd be cool. Like, that's how I would want it to go down.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I am liking all of these ideas we came up with.
So if you liked these ideas too, you should let us know. You can catch us on Blue Sky and Threads. Jared, where are you on Blue Sky?
I am at What Do I Know JR, which is what I am almost everywhere now.
Yeah, I'm Chris Sneezek, I think I'm both, so you can find me there. Maybe Sealight 101. I always forget.
No time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
So every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. Jared, would you mind going first?
Sure. So a while ago, there were some rumblings that there were going to be D&D stamps coming out from the U.S. Postal Service. And we now have some more information on that. And it may be a little bit harder to get a hold of them than some of the other commemorative stamps, depending on whether this information is what it sounds like it is. They're debuting the stamps at Gen Con. And they're specifically saying that they are going to be for sale at Lucas Oil Stadium and the Indianapolis Post Office. But there have been some venues that have taken this to mean that is the only place they are going to be sold. And if that's the case, I am extremely disappointed that we finally get D&D stamps and they decide to make an extremely limited run of them. I'm kind of hoping that just means that's where they're going to roll out to begin with. My daughter works for the post office, so I was definitely going to have her pick some of these up for me if they do go into wide sale. So we're going to include a link here so you can go look at it, read the press release, see if it makes more sense to you whether or not this is only going to happen at Gen Con or not. But I would love to see these stamps. They look really neat. I have not been much of a philatelist in my adult life, but I would definitely get these.
Of course you would, because it's Dungeons and Dragons, right? Like, I mean, we're nerds. We do stuff like that. So I'm unabashedly a Dimension 20 and Brendan Lee Mulligan fan. I love everything that Dropout does. Their summer series for Dimension 20 is called Never Stop Blowing Up. This is not exactly D&D, but it's 5e, so close enough. I'm perfectly fine with that. If you haven't watched the trailer, there's going to be a link on the website. Go watch the trailer. If you've never wanted to watch an actual play, if this doesn't make you want to watch an actual play, for all you people that loved 80s action movies and 90s action movies, then it will. I don't know, Jared, have you seen the trailer for this?
I have. It is ridiculous and I love it. And it made me think of all of the movies that I stayed up until like 2 o'clock in the morning watching on HBO when we first got cable.
So many, like Die Hard and Rambo and Cobra and all of those terrible 80s like Predator and anything from that time period. It's just like there. Tango and Cash, I feel like, is being referenced in this thing. I think I already mentioned Lethal Weapon. Even like Beverly Hills Cop, you could even throw that movie in there if you wanted to. I mean, Beverly Hills Cop's got really good action.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly so for being a comedy. I mean, the movie Cobra is what came of one of the original scripts of Beverly Hills Cop, if anybody didn't know that. That's really funny. But yeah, it's called Never Stop Blowing Up. It's coming from Dimension 20. It is 80s action ridiculousness using the 5th edition rule set by Dimension 20, which means the production levels will be out of this world in the dome. Explosions.
Boom.
Everywhere. Watch the trailer.
We are happily part of the Polygamerist Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamerist podcast like...
Man, it's the Gnomecast. There are several gnomes from the Gnome Stew. They all get together to talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and hopefully avoid being thrown into the stew.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us again when we start our next adventure.